The report we've all been waiting for is finally out. No, not that one. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. While lots of people were eagerly digesting a certain report from the Department of Justice, there were a select few poring over the details of another long-awaited document, the U.S. International Trade Commission's independent assessment of how an updated NAFTA, now known as the USMCA, will affect the U.S. economy. President Trump has touted USMCA as a big improvement over its predecessor. Anyway, the big takeaway here is that if implemented, the new NAFTA would have a small, positive impact on the U.S. economy. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has more.
When the International Trade Commission tallied up all the different ways the USMCA's new rules and provisions will ripple out through different industries, it found the U.S. economy will be 0.35% larger with the USMCA in place than it would be if we just stuck with the old NAFTA. 0.35%.
I'm surprised it's so large, even though it's still a very small number.
Doug Irwin is a trade economist at Dartmouth College.
This is an incremental change on an agreement that's already pretty pre-trade.
But some of the biggest differences impact the auto industry, like increasing the share of cars and car parts that have to come from the three NAFTA countries. The report found those changes will have a mixed impact. Inu Monik is a visiting scholar at the Cato Institute.
Cars are going to become a little bit more expensive in the United States, and not as many people are going to buy them, although there will be more employment in that sector.
The report is one step in the USMCA's long journey through Congress. But Manick says its findings aren't likely to change many politicians' minds. Those for or against the deal will likely stay that way. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Walmart and Amazon are now accepting SNAP benefits, what we usually refer to as food stamps, for online grocery delivery in New York. This is part of a Department of Agriculture pilot program. Marketplace's Ben Bradford reports this could help connect low-income communities to healthy food.
The USDA calculates as many as 54 million Americans live in food deserts, low-income communities where people may struggle to get to supermarkets. Charles Platkin at the Hunter College Food Policy Center says online grocery delivery could help.
Healthy food access is so important. Here is a solution that doesn't have infrastructure costs.
Amazon is accepting SNAP payments for online orders in New York City, while Walmart is covering upstate New York. One concern, Platkin says, is that people still must pay delivery fees out of pocket.
$3, $5, $6, $8, that's significant to a family that's, watching their budget.
Another challenge, low-income households may also have less access to internet. Jane Adams at the nonprofit Bread for the World says retailers have a financial incentive to encourage the program's success.
Big grocery store chains like Walmart, Amazon, et cetera. Frankly, SNAP recipients make up a huge portion of their revenues.
The USDA plans to roll in more retailers in coming months and as many as 8 other states. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
Let's do the numbers. The Nikkei closed up 0.5%. That's in Japan. The Hang Seng in Hong Kong closed down 0.5%. U.S. markets are closed for Good Friday.
Not everyone gets a chance to study the economy in school. Anyway, who doesn't need a brush up? Marketplace helps you continue your education in a way that we hope is smart, accessible, and hopefully even a bit fun. Your donation is not only an investment in your learning, but also in helping us make more people smart about the economy. And that, we think, is good for everyone. To learn how you can help, visit marketplace.org/investors. Thank you.
In the 2 weeks after getting out of prison, former inmates are 40 times more likely to die of an opioid overdose than anyone else in the general population. This is in a study recently published in the American Journal of Public Health. So jails and prisons have found themselves on the front lines of addressing addiction. Some, not many, but some, are considering treating inmates for addiction using medication. This season of our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, is all about drug epidemics and how they end. And its newest episode is all about addiction treatment. So with all that in mind, Kelly Moore joins us. She's a professor at Eastern Tennessee State University. Welcome.
Good morning.
Why is it that inmates are so much more likely to die of an opioid overdose than almost anyone else?
What happens is when people get arrested and incarcerated, if they used opioids before they were arrested and got involved in the justice system, they have to go through a period of withdrawal. And then their tolerance to opioids decreases when they get released and they go to use the same type or amount of opioids they might have used prior to incarceration, they don't have the same tolerance, and that is largely what increases their overdose risk.
How could jails intercept that outcome exactly?
The biggest thing is by providing medication-assisted treatment during incarceration for people who come in with an opioid problem. So methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone are the three main medications that have been shown to be effective in reducing craving and withdrawal.
How effective is this type of treatment?
In an ideal world, if they were able to get that medication-assisted treatment during incarceration and continue that post-release, my study has shown that can reduce their likelihood of engaging in a variety of offenses and getting rearrested for a variety of offenses. So we have preliminary evidence that that would be effective. So we have to look at whether they got it during incarceration as well as if they continued it post-release and looking at their recidivism risk. A lot of studies just look at whether people got the medication while they were incarcerated and whether they then are likely to be rearrested. But we're missing that key variable there of whether they continued it post-release.
Why is this not commonplace?
There are just a lot of barriers to implementing treatments in jails, and a lot of it has to do with the logistical barriers and the financial issues, staffing issues that jails across America face. There's kind of a belief that these treatments are substituting one drug for the other, or you're allowing people to kind of just continue to get high off of things like methadone. And that's just not true, but there's a lot of misconceptions about the medication-assisted treatment right now, especially in the justice system.
Kelly Moore is a licensed clinical psychologist and assistant professor at East Tennessee State University. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Our executive producer is Nicole Childers. Our digital producer is Miguel Contreras. Our engineer is Brian Allison. And I'm Sabri Benishour with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.